I was elected by men and women of all parties and none, by many with great moral courage, who stepped out from the faded flags of the Civil War and voted for a new Ireland, and above all, by the women of Ireland, Manon Aheron.
She was a total tomboy. Wasn't she brought up by her four brothers? And what else could she be?
There was a kind of a driving force behind her. I mean, she was genuinely committed. She was intellectually excited by the law.
How dare any political party talk about political hooks when we should be changing the law in order to make life better and healthier and saner for the people of this country, for the women of this country and the children of this country?
We are marching to stop the destruction of Wood Quay, and we are marching for the construction of civic offices to be constructed elsewhere.
I have such a sense of what the world must take responsibility for.
To my mind, her feminist thing, or her all this, is the law. The sheer inequality of the law was the one to put right.
I am of Ireland. Come dance with me in Ireland. Gur Míle maith agaibh go léir.
Mary Robinson, in earlier programmes you spoke about growing up in Ballina, your days at boarding school, your Trinity connections as student, teacher and senator, your work as a campaigning lawyer and your presidential years from 1990 to 1997. All the time you were using your skills as a lawyer to attempt to effect change, first in Ireland and then wider afield. And your job after being president was as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. Now, going to Geneva with that new challenge, it was a huge challenge, wasn't it?
It really was, because I had come from a very well-functioning office of president to a small office with a huge mandate to give leadership on human rights for the whole UN system. And yet the office itself was a bit demoralised. It had not been well structured. There was a previous Centre for Human Rights that wasn't well linked with the Office of High Commissioner for Human Rights. And I underestimated all the administrative problems, even of getting new staff. It could take so long to hire somebody, and I couldn't hire somebody that might be the best person. It had to be also geographically well balanced. And all of these things were both new and difficult. And I found that everybody was complaining about the lack of resources, about the lack of support for their mandate they were doing or their treaty body. And I was somehow in the hot seat.
And at one stage, Kofi Annan, when you asked him how you could reconcile all of these goals, peace and security, economic, social affairs, development, cooperation, humanitarian affairs, his response was?
He smiled at me and he said, Mary, that's for you to figure out how the Office of High Commissioner could fill that role that he had made very clear in his reform package. And I found that I was getting up earlier every morning, staying longer in the office, and I began taking sleeping pills because I was so worried. I wasn't sleeping well at night. And so between September of 1997 and that first Christmas as High Commissioner, I found it the hardest work and the most difficult, and that I was finding it very difficult to get totally on top of it, and it was taking its toll.
And what was the office like in Geneva?
It was a part of the big Palais des Nations, but it was a sort of backwater. I had a nice office, but most of my staff were in cubbyhole offices along what I would call hospital corridors, not even all together. And that was a problem. We had to hold on to any office materials because we were in such short supply that people would pinch from each other. And I had to go and fundraise with various governments to get extra budgetary resources. And then I had to be careful not to just go to Western governments. So I would go to small developing countries and say, I want the office to be seen as global and in favour of a balanced human rights. Please give some support.
And was there a conflict there between criticising some governments on their lack of human rights record and asking them for resources? That wasn't an ideal relationship.
To an extent, but that is part of the role of the High Commissioner. It's very important to be very direct with representatives of government and say, you know, I have the evidence here that your government is in fact violating human rights. You are not observing your commitments under the covenants or conventions. And I never had difficulty, I must say, looking ministers or even presidents in the eye and telling them that. Whether it's growing up with the four brothers or whatever, but I never really had a problem with that. And sometimes you had to to marry that with also looking for support. But on the whole, the main donor governments, or Western governments, wanted at least, you know, the High Commissioner to be tough on certain governments. When I turned to them and said, but, you know, your migrant policy, or, you know, they're not so good, that could sometimes be a difficulty.
And what about the personnel you had? Because some of them were on short contracts and some of them were on comfortable contracts, and they weren't necessarily the hardest workers. So you were inheriting a lot of problems, management problems, human resources problems.
Very real human resources problems, because some of the best human rights officers, the most dedicated, were literally on monthly contracts and needed them, you know, to be renewed. And I was trying to get them better contracts. I spoke quite a bit with Secretary General Kofi Annan about needing more staff for a start, but also more security of contracts. And he, you know, was reassuring, but it was difficult. And it was always difficult to get new posts for human rights, because that was the political area.
And so your estimate of the UN there, your first impressions of the United Nations, what were?
I was very surprised at how chaotic it was. I even found uncashed checks in our liaison office in New York in drawers. Bright Rosny was very outspoken about what she felt about the UN. I gradually appreciated that the United Nations is a bit like what Winston Churchill said about democracy. He said democracy is the worst system except for all the others. The UN is not a great cohesive system, but it is vital to the world, and I will always be loyal to it for that reason.
But you were, in a very early speech, you were very critical. You said that many in the UN had lost the plot. You said this at Oxford. Many in the UN had lost the plot. They had allowed their work to answer to other imperatives.
And that was something that I felt very strongly about, that in these important executive committees on peace and security, on humanitarian affairs, human rights were not as much a priority. And the United Nations didn't seem to understand the importance of its normative framework. And I constantly repeated that criticism. I was rapt a little bit by Kofi Annan after that speech. He rang me and said, Mary, you know, you have to be part of the team and you must be loyal. And I said, I am being loyal. I'm being loyal to the truth of the UN system, that it must value its normative system and hold governments accountable to it. About a month later, that speech was published by the publicity arm of the UN, and it was very much a speech that people, you know, congratulated me on afterwards.
And when you went to the UN, amongst the other points that you made, this was one of your central themes.
Let's recognise, here in the context of the Commission, that the international community has tended to react to human rights violations after the event. I believe that we can and must take effective steps to prevent and forestall situations where human rights violations are threatened.
So anticipating issues was really something that was being neglected, you felt?
Very much so. And that was partly why I felt that what I could do in the small office as High Commissioner was go to where victims were suffering violations and help them to get their voices out, their concerns. And it was clear, you know, going there, whether it was East Timor or parts of the Democratic Republic of Congo or Chechnya, that I couldn't actually do it. I couldn't bring them effective answers or remedies, but I could help to get their voice to the Commission on Human Rights. And, you know, we got a resolution against the Russian Federation for the first time ever for what they were doing in Chechnya. We drew attention to the refugees in Kosovo and the need for more support. And sometimes I had to criticise, for example, NATO bombing in a way that was hurting poor communities, because I was in Serbia and happened to go into the town of Niš and saw cluster bombs in high-rise flats. And when I reported on that, again, I got rapped by Kofi Annan, because that was embarrassing him with NATO.
And so did you think he was less than fully supportive?
I think he was a very good Secretary General for Human Rights. But there were always times in practice, sometimes his office would, you know, be part of the problem. And it wasn't always Kofi himself. But there were times, I think, when I was an awkward voice and he was trying to negotiate something very delicate and diplomatic, and suddenly the High Commissioner was criticising NATO. That's the way it is. And that's the way probably it has to be.
And did any of the skills that you'd learnt as president in the Irish context, to some extent, you're repeating this behaviour of going into the place, going into the terrain and being there for people?
I think the skills very much did carry over. because it was a little bit like going to Somalia or going to Rwanda, but also the diplomatic skills. I had learned to be very diplomatic with ambassadors, with ministers, and yet to be firm. So sometimes it was the diplomatic route to try to get effect. I tried that very hard in China. I negotiated with China with respect in order that China would pay more attention to human rights. But I was also the strongest voice speaking out about the violations of human rights, whether it was political dissidents or Falun Gong or Tibetan monks and nuns and civilians. I spoke truth to power, but I also had learned skills of diplomacy from my time, particularly as president.
And to develop the visit to China, initially they didn't want you to visit Tibet. They didn't want you to add Tibet to that visit.
That's right. The China wanted me to come as the first High Commissioner to visit because it was the 50th anniversary year, 1998, of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And they wanted my visit to somehow prove that they should be less investigated in the Commission on Human Rights. And I would only go to China if they let me go to Tibet. And in the end, the conversation was very interesting because the ambassador, Ambassador Wu, said to me, you know, when you come to Shanghai, you'll see in a square a sign, no dogs or Chinese. And I said, looking him in the eye, I said, I perfectly understand. We had many times as Irish people, no Irish allowed. And then he looked at me and he said, send me a history of your people. And after that, I was allowed to go to Tibet. And that was an important part of that first visit.
And what were your impressions of Tibet?
It was such a contrast to a China that was becoming an emerging economy even then. It was spiritual, and yet it was desolate because the people were afraid to talk to me. They would whisper out of the corner of their mouth, there's a nun and she's imprisoned. We want to be free for our culture. And going into the school in Lhasa, I was handing out small copies of the Universal Declaration in the Tibetan language. And one of my officers said, you know, this might be something that will get us into trouble. And I kind of said, I don't care. I'm the High Commissioner. And so there was that fear factor. But they are a beautiful people, a wonderful people, very spiritual, very gentle. And at the same time, clearly you could see the suffering. And it is a very much a human rights issue, how the Han population is being imposed, the main Chinese population is being imposed, a little bit like the settlements that we suffered in Ireland. I could identify with how they felt.
And the press relations in that visit were unhappy because Conor O'Clery, for instance, of the Irish Times, he reckoned he had been marginalised and the Irish Times ran a headline that you were responsible.
That's right. I tell that story in the book. It's hard to tell in a couple of sentences, but I was keen to have as much press coverage of my visit, and especially of Tibet. And I was under a lot of pressure from international press, you know, the International Herald Tribune, the Financial Times, Washington Post, all of these wanted to come to Tibet. And I learned, and I was glad, that Conor O'Clery was going to come and that RTE would also come because they had permission. But I felt, you know, I'm a global United Nations High Commissioner. I must try and get other press. And the Chinese basically played us off. They didn't want coverage of the visit to Tibet. So they dropped Conor O'Clery. Now, I'm the first to say it could have been better handled. Bride Rosny was no longer with me. I had a new, a good but not as skillful because he hadn't learned all the tricks, press and communications officer. And somehow the Chinese simply managed to take advantage of what seemed to be a row, but what was actually more my concern, to have several print journalists coming with me.
But you are, the office can be used and was being used by the Chinese, wasn't it? I mean, some people would think human rights and China is an oxymoron. So
I actually don't believe that. I was making considerable progress on human rights in China as High Commissioner because I was taking a double track. I was respecting China for the fact that it had signed the two big covenants and ratified the covenant on economic, social and cultural rights, which the United States still hasn't done, and doing workshops with me where they were bringing their people. You know, a big country like China with no tradition of human rights has to learn and has to be talked to. But the other track was standing up for and being very clear and speaking truth to power about the violations of human rights. And I really felt that that was the way that we deal with human rights in China. And to some extent, since then, I think the UN has not been quite as forceful in the two-track approach to human rights in China. And that's a mistake.
And what do you say to those who would say, well, human rights, this is a Western idea? anyway.
That's not what people feel. The ordinary Chinese increasingly want human rights, and that's very clear. And that's why you have so many disputes, and on the website they're censored, etc. They want human rights. The people who would say human rights are a Western idea were leaders who were basically dictators. They love to say this is not our culture. And I, by being able to meet with even the All China Federation for Women, they wanted the full Universal Declaration, the Convention for the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, which China had ratified. These are the tools that work their way slowly through countries that don't have a long culture and tradition of human rights.
And being former president of Ireland, did that open any doors? Did it provide any difficulties in terms of protocols, anything like that?
It opened doors in a number of countries, but particularly in China, because I was able to have several meetings with the then president, Jiang Zemin, and we had wonderful discussions, some of which I recall in the book, because he was meeting me as a high-level official of the UN, but I would not have had access if I hadn't been a former president. And I must say, it helped me in many places. It complicated my life in Rwanda. I had been a beloved president who had paid three visits to Rwanda, the third one being for a Pan-African Women's Conference. But on my first visit as High Commissioner for Human Rights, there was a coldness because I represented the UN that had failed Rwanda. And that was a very difficult visit. And I was in that first few months where I was stressed, and I don't think I handled it well. I was angry with how I had been treated, and I spoke very sharply about Rwanda needing to respect human rights more. Rwanda was still recovering from the terrible genocidal killing. And I remember on the plane flying from there to South Africa saying to myself, you know, I didn't handle that as well as I should have. And that was very tough.
But how did the coldness express itself?
Oh, I was very well briefed on the fact that Rwanda was coping well with its own internal, very difficult problems, but it had already started to support militias in the Democratic Republic of Congo and to use that to benefit from the resources of the DRC. And I raised this with President Kagame, and he was furious and said, no UN official is going to talk to me about what we're doing, etc. And so the meeting broke up in some disarray. It has clearly been a bad pattern of Rwanda then and since.
And what had you said in the press conference that so annoyed them?
I had spoken about the need for Rwanda to pay more attention to the problem of the prison camps, which were full of prisoners who were suffering from gangrene and suffering from terrible deprivation. And I tried to do it in a way which understood their problems too. And then I also referred to the situation of what Rwanda was doing in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And I think the tone was a tone of, you need to address your problems. And because I felt that they were very critical of the United Nations, but not looking at their own situation. I didn't understand, I think, sufficiently how beleaguered Rwanda still felt.
So the new job was extraordinarily challenging. And you felt at the same time, in one phrase in your book, you say, meanwhile, there were people throwing sand in the wheels of the UN machine.
Yes, there were governments who got up very early in the morning to try to block any good resolutions or any resolutions to hold countries to account, countries like Iran, etc. And these were, you know, Egypt, Cuba, etc. And I really wondered why some of the countries that support human rights didn't work quite so hard to get resolutions passed through. And we used to joke about that the network of bad countries was somehow much more organized to try to prevent progress. But over time, as the office strengthened, and this was one of the things that I was really very happy about, we got more resources. We moved to the Palais Wilson, our new headquarters. I had an office that was cohesive, and we began to really get on top of these things and to give that leadership at all levels. And I have very happy memories of, say, the last 3 years as High Commissioner for that reason, even though we had a lot of difficulties.
Then the World Conference Against Racism, that was a very important initiative. And you felt that the American in the Clinton, at the end of the Clinton administration, that they were supportive.
Yes, and I recognised that it was going to be difficult. There had been two previous attempts to have a successful world conference against racism and they had failed. But after the terrible genocidal killing in Rwanda, the world leaders felt we do need to address hatred and racism and xenophobia, etc. So I was aware that this was a huge human rights issue that my office must embrace on top of all our other work. And we tried extraordinarily hard, and the World Conference is preceded by regional conferences. And unfortunately, in the Asian Regional Conference, which again, unfortunately, was held in Iran, anti-Semitism crept into what we call square brackets, not agreed language, but it was there. And if it wasn't agreed, it would be dropped at the end. But nonetheless, it was there. And it offended a lot of Jewish communities, understandably, particularly in the United States. And when the Bush administration took over, they were more hardline on this issue of the World Conference, threatening at all times that they would not attend, or if they did attend, as happened, they would withdraw if this language was not removed at the beginning, rather than not agreed at the end and therefore dropped.
And you had difficulty, had you, in persuading them that, look, this is a convention. If it's within square brackets, it won't survive the final text. But they took offence at the fact that it was there at all.
Yes, and there was a very leading congressman, Tom Lantos, who had a huge influence. And I had been, very much a friend of, and indeed Tom Lantos was my big champion when I was President of Ireland visiting the United States and Congress, or as High Commissioner until then. And then he sort of blamed me. He said, "This is your conference, Mary." And I tried to explain to him I was Secretary General of the conference, but it was the member states who were determining what the language would be.
And generally, the Bush administration, the incoming Bush administration, was not sympathetic anyway.
That's right. And ultimately, the United States, when this language was not withdrawn after 36 hours, withdrew and Israel withdrew. And we thought the conference might collapse. I had forged a very good friendship with Lamini Zuma, the woman foreign minister who was chair of the conference. And Louis Michel, the Belgian foreign minister who happened to have the presidency of the EU, had come as EU president, and he was about to leave. I joined the two of them in a room, and they were saying, "Look, with the United States and Israel not here, I think this conference is not going to succeed like the other two." And I very much argued with them and persuaded and said, "Look, South Africa can persuade countries that this language in brackets has to be dropped now. Unusually, rather than at the end because it isn't agreed. And we can go forward and South Africa can lead." And Louis Michel had his hand on the phone and I literally begged him. And he said to me, "Mary, you don't have to beg. I will stay for as long as it takes." And that was what made a huge difference. We had all night sittings. I'll never forget it. I describe it in the book as like a Kafka-like situation, as Ronan Murphy, who was advising me, said. But the following morning, it was agreed that the text, the offending text, would be removed. We had all the other issues, and that we would continue. And I still remember the exhaustion in the face of the foreign minister, Lamini Zuma, when she went into that meeting, and how she lifted the whole meeting. And we continued and got a good final text with no offending language and a great text for tackling racism, for migrants, for issues of cross-sectoral discrimination, of gender and racism, a really important text which is now being built on.
And how would you measure success or otherwise on this huge agenda that you were attempting?
Unfortunately, it's not a real answer to your question, but we never had a proper assessment of the World Conference Against Racism because 3 days later, there was the terrible attack in the United States of what we now call 9/11.
And you remember, we all remember where we were when we heard of that. What is your response?
I will never forget where I was. I was taking a short break in Ireland and I was on the Inishki beautiful islands off Belmullet with my brother Adrian and his wife Ruth and the local parish priest. We were shocked to hear from the boatman, who was also a friend, that there had been planes had attacked the Twin Towers and they were heading for the White House. It didn't seem credible. But Adrian and Ruth were shocked because their son and his girlfriend worked as lawyers very close to the Twin Towers. And we went back silently in that boat the whole day, even though it was still sunny, destroyed by this fear. My nephew and his girlfriend were all right, but I could see on the small television in Belmullet, in Vincent's home, that this was going to be terrible for the protection of human rights, and it was terrible for those who were going to be killed.
And we'll discuss its impact on your agenda after this break.